This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. When the United States began bombing Iraq on January 16th, only a handful of Americans had even heard of the Kurdish people who live in northern Iraq. Today, in the aftermath of Saddam Hussein's defeat and his subsequent bloody suppression of Kurdish rebels, the plight of the Kurds has become one of the great tragedies of the war. As many as 500 Kurds are said to be dying in mountain refugee camps daily. This morning's newspapers reported a possible accord between Hussein and Kurdish leaders that could allow the Kurds to return home and win a measure of autonomy. Robin Wright, a reporter in the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau, has long experience in the Middle East. She says there's still not much reason to be hopeful about the Kurds' future.
Saddam Hussein has made many promises in the past and not followed through. This is an agreement only in principle. The details still have to be worked out. It strikes me that there are many obstacles in the path to a full agreement that is going to satisfy the Kurds and at the same time keep Saddam Hussein in power. The danger here is that that by allowing the Kurds autonomy in the north, he then paves the way for similar demands by the predominantly Shiite community in southern Iraq. There's another danger, and that is that the terms of autonomy include the use of the vast oil revenues generated in northern Kurdistan for Kurdish use rather than handing all of them over to the central government.
So what's that going to mean for Hussein's future then?
Well, Saddam Hussein is terribly in debt, which was one of the motivations for invading Kuwait in the first place. He was in debt before he went into the war, and now the damage is estimated between $100 and $150 billion to reconstruct Iraq out of what the UN calls a pre-industrial level. He also has debts ranging up to $40 billion to Europe and other Gulf countries predating this crisis. And then on top of that, there's the issue of reparations to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and potentially even Israel over the damage done during the Gulf War. So this is going to cost Saddam a lot, not only politically, but also financially at a time he needs money more than ever before.
So why is he smiling in the pictures that we see in Thursday's newspapers, kissing the cheeks of the Kurdish leader?
Saddam Hussein traditionally has done what has been politically expedient, made promises, be it to other countries or to his own people, and turned around and rather shrewdly slipped out of them. For example, in 1988, he and the Iranians agreed to the terms of a UN ceasefire to end the bloody eight-year Gulf War. To this day, however, he still has troops inside Iran, and there is no formal ceasefire. That was something he, 2 years after the original agreement last August, when he felt the pressure of the deployment by the United States and its coalition partners, agreed to finally formalize it, to give the Iranians virtually everything they wanted. But 8 months after that, we still don't have a formal ceasefire to end the previous Gulf War. Saddam Hussein promises a lot, but, as I said, rarely follows through with the full terms of the agreement. There's a real danger here that he could make promises to the Kurds. Many of them might go home, only to find that they're not getting what they promised, either politically, in terms of running an autonomous region in northern Iraq, or having the kind of revenues they need to support an autonomous government.
Well, but no one understands this better than the Kurds. I mean, they have a history of punctured promises from all sides, from the West, from Iran, from Iraq, from virtually everyone they've ever dealt with. So we're not talking about a naive set of people. You've reported from the Middle East since long before it was fashionable. Take us, if you can, a little more inside of what the expectations may be. Why would they be promoting this agreement, since they have plenty of reason to distrust it even more than you do?
Well, Talabani, one of the leaders who met with Saddam Hussein secretly over the last few days, came out and pointed out immediately that this was agreement only in principle and that the details would have to be worked out next week and probably beyond that. I think that we will probably get some kind of indication of how much the Kurds trust Saddam Hussein or even trust some of their own leaders when they make a decision about whether to go back inside Iraq. And that will be the real test. I just have some serious doubts about whether the Kurds will get what they want. And I think that there are probably suspicions they're hopeful. They've been granted, told that they're going to get everything they want. But I think it may be months before we find out whether this is a real deal, a real change in the status of a community, the fifth largest ethnic group in the Middle East that has suffered not just repeatedly this century, but for centuries because they're divided between five states, and none of the five states want to give up any territory for fear that that will set a precedent that will then lead Kurds in neighboring communities to ask for the same thing, and it would break up the borders of five countries and potentially destabilize a whole region.
How do you see Saddam Hussein's future now? For some months we've been hearing that he has no future, that he will be destroyed. Now we see him negotiating with the Kurds. The Shiite minority in the southern part of Iraq seems to be displeased with these conversations going on between the Kurds and Iraq and Hussein. Is Hussein pulling it out?
I think that there are a number of things that are pulling and tugging on Saddam. There are very few people, both inside Iraq and outside, who believe he's going to die a natural death in his bed. Most everyone assumes that he will be overthrown at some point. The issue is by whom and over what issues. The irony is that the Kurds and the Shiites, despite the fact they make up more than 70% of Iraq's population, have never been the ones who were strong enough, either politically or in terms of the arsenals in the hands of their opposition movements, to overthrow Saddam's regime. It was always going to take someone within his inner circle, one of three various parties, the military, the Revolutionary Command Council, or his own ruling Ba'ath Party, to move against him. I think for the time being, Saddam has bought some time, in part because of the uprisings, which mobilized a lot of people within his own community, within the Sunni Muslim community, around him, because they feared the dangers of the Kurds and the Shia gaining some kind of control over the country. And so that the uprisings, which lasted between 3 weeks and a month, really gave him an opportunity after the war to reconsolidate his hold, not just on Iraq, but on large parts of the country. And he may, for the short term, have weathered the worst part of the storm. There are experts on the Kurds who believe that he could survive a couple of years or more now, that the issue that will be of the greatest challenge to him will be economic, because there are not many countries who are going to be willing to do business with Saddam Hussein on reconstruction, rebuilding oil refineries needed for revenue in that country, because that's the primary source of foreign exchange, well, as long as Saddam's in power. And the issue of sanctions that the United Nations make it very difficult immediately to begin rebuilding bridges, to restore electricity, to get phone lines going again. I mean, this is a country that really has incredible devastation to its infrastructure, and it will be the kind of slow economic squeeze that lead people within Saddam's circle to see that all of their plans to rebuild the country really are being stalled only because of one man. And at that juncture, they will move to replace him. The problem is there will probably be someone somewhat like him who takes over, which is not necessarily going to help the plight of the Kurds in the north, the Shia in the south, or Iraq's position as a single-party state.
Well, what should we be watching for in the next few weeks, and especially on this question of autonomy?
The details that still have to be worked out are pivotal in determining whether there really will be a truly autonomous Kurdistan in northern Iraq. And they send around the handover of political power. Who rules? Who are the governors in the provinces? The mayors in the cities, are they pro-Saddam flunkies, or are they truly Kurds elected by their own people in democratic, free, and fair contests? The distribution of oil revenues in the Kurdish areas for use by the Kurds in developing the very poor north. The issue of...
Well, let's talk about the oil for a second. How can any nation permit one portion of its population to hold on exclusively to its most valuable resource?
Well, the argument by the Kurds has always been that the revenues from their part of the country have gone to the central government for its use rather than for building roads, clinics, schools, the basic things needed in that part of the country, and that they've gone for those issues, gone for those purposes, but to benefit rival communities or to help the state's intelligence apparatus, which then represses the Kurds in the north. So I think that the Kurds may not claim, again, there are no specifics in this arrangement. The Kurds may ask for a certain percentage of the oil revenues to be kept in Kurdistan for their use. But it's a very complex issue, and of course there's a real danger that if Saddam Hussein agrees to that, he will then have to do something similar in the Shiite south, where another good chunk of his oil wells are. And if Iraq does that, then that opens the way for similar demands among other Gulf countries. For example, in Saudi Arabia, the Shiite are a minority, a very small minority, but they do occupy and work most of the oil fields. And there were riots 10 years ago over the issue of revenues from oil going to the central government in Riyadh rather than to build schools and clinics and roads and basic development projects in the eastern oil fields for the Shiite community. So this is a precedent that has very important weight, not only for throughout Iraq, but also throughout the Gulf.
Aside from oil interests and apportioning a certain amount of the oil from the Kurdish territories to Kurdish needs, what else would an autonomous Kurdish state mean? What would it look like?
An autonomous Kurdish state would really mean Kurds running Kurdistan, the northern provinces of Iraq, rather than Saddam Hussein's appointees. It would involve Kurds policing the area, administering social and social services. There would be no disagreement on foreign policy or currency and banking, but on all the key issues. It would, in effect, be like a state within the United States that has control over its own revenues and many of its own laws that may differ in terms of what Baghdad deems legal. It could become a de facto state if the Kurds are to get what they have been promised, which is one of the reasons I'm so skeptical. I can't imagine Saddam Hussein being willing to give up that much power. The game for him throughout the Gulf War was not just a game of absorbing the oil wealth of Kuwait. It was one of power in which he wanted to be the not only the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, but the dominant power in the 22-member Arab bloc. He wanted to be able to dictate everything from oil pricing to the terms for an Arab-Israeli peace. This is what his game has always been about. That was what his game was also in his invasion of Iran in 1980. So I think that the chances of Saddam Hussein really turning over enough power to satisfy the Kurds are highly unlikely, because it would go against everything he has fought his entire life to achieve.
Los Angeles Times reporter Robin Wright is a specialist in Middle Eastern affairs. This is Fresh Air.